Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Ukraine Calling. I'm Bohdan Nahailo for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and as always, we're bringing you our feature interview, followed by some new music from Ukraine. This week, our guest is David Plaster, an inspiring American ex-combat medic turned philanthropist who has launched a number of projects in Ukraine, ranging from medical training for Ukrainian military to free English language courses. To know why and how, I invite you to listen to our discussion. Well, I'm very happy to have as my guest this week for Ukraine Calling, David Plaster, an American who is doing very good work here in many spheres in Ukraine and has been here for a few years. David, I can describe him, but he'll tell us in his own words what he does. He's a former U.S. Army combat medic, now a philanthropist, has set up various NGOs here. So welcome to the program.
Welcome.
Okay, David, the traditional question is, what brought you to Ukraine and when did you arrive here?
Well, I've known about Ukraine for many years, had many friends my time in the military that were Ukrainian, and I was invited in 2012. It seemed logical when I finally finished the military that I made my own decisions on where I could go and how long. So I came to Ukraine. I had
a lot
of friends.
Were you in some difficult places, hot spots, if it's not a secret?
Oh, just the Middle East.
The Middle East. Okay, yeah. That says
a lot of beach, but not a lot of water.
Okay, I understand. So you arrived here, you said when? 2012?
2012.
Different sort of scene then, huh? This is before Maidan. This is Yanukovych era.
Honestly, I wasn't really interested in politics. I was more interested in football. And
an American interested in football.
I played semi-professionally for about 6 years during my time in the military. Wow. And a little before.
Interesting. What position?
I played center forward.
Wow.
But it was like a withdrawn striker, so.
Yes, yes. Very interesting. Okay, so you arrive here 2012. Why then?
Like I said, I was invited. I have a lot of friends that were from the military that have given me many invitations over the, say, at least 7 or so years before that. And I finally took them up on it.
Were you treated, did you feel that you were being treated suspiciously, U.S. military in the Yanukovych time? Did you feel that, you know, somebody was interested in your presence here?
I mean, I wasn't wearing a uniform while I was on Krasiatyk or anything, if you're asking. But I just came here as a civilian. I already had a beard. Nobody really asked any questions, honestly. They just saw I was an American, and I quickly went through security because I guess I had dollars.
Okay. Those were important then and still are. Anyway, so let's jump ahead. Suddenly it's 2013 and things are happening out on the streets. Were you affected by the Maidan?
Well, the end of November 2013, I was drinking beer with some friends when things started going down. So, young students running for their lives, being terrorized by the people who were supposed to be civil servants and protecting them, disturbed me very much.
Did you get involved yourself?
Yes.
And so what, you were on the Maidan, you were helping the medics?
I lived on Maidan for the whole time, nearly, from the beginning till the end, through all of it.
In one of the sotnyas or as an individual? Or?
As an individual. I wasn't, because of my past and what I saw for the future of Ukraine, I felt it was best that I didn't involve myself very officially or directly. Briefly take a step back, 2012, 2013, New Year's, after I had traveled the entire country and saw every region of Ukraine, and my friends told me that they were jealous that even they hadn't seen as much as Ukraine as I have, I saw this something very disturbing, how two parts of the country being pitted against each other. And I made this prediction that by the end of the year, there would be another revolution. But it wouldn't be orange, it wouldn't be blue, it wouldn't be yellow. It would be blood red. And it would lead to a war, because it was just a brewing tension. It was something I'd felt from my military experience. So when this came in November, I wasn't surprised that things were happening, that the government would do that. That was not surprising to me at all. But I decided, after I saw the horrific beatings at the end of November of 2013, when I was at St. Michael's Cathedral here in Kyiv, that I made a promise that if I'm going to be here, if this is my new home, if this is where I live, that I'm going to be here until the end of the revolution. and to help in the war to come, if necessary.
Very admirable. And, of course, that revolution of dignity went on for quite a few months and had a bloody ending, though perhaps not an ending, but, shall we say, an interval, followed by supposed victory, at least a clearing of the air, an opening of opportunities. What were your feelings on the Maidan on the days of the largest number of killings? Did you think it was all over, that they're just going to crush us militarily?
Well, from the beginning, I told people that if they think this is going to be a peaceful revolution, back in the beginning of December, when there was lots of happy sing-songs, and every hour singing the hymn of Ukraine, when the clock tower still worked on Maidan, before the building was burned, I told people that they're crazy if you think that this is not going to end, if this is going to end in a peaceful way and there's going to be a peaceful transition of power. There's never been a peaceful transition of power from a tyrannical dictatorship government that was the Yanukovych style of government that I understand in the history of mankind, at least not in the history of Ukrainian history. So I felt that it was very necessary to seek peace but prepare for war. And you're in a valley. You're surrounded by tall buildings, all of them sniper perches. You could be assaulted from underground from the metro station very easily. You could be surrounded by all sides and blocked in and starved to death through the winter. And I told people, if you can just make it through the New Year's holidays, through Christmas, through Old New Year, then it will get much worse. Because then they understand you're serious and you're not going home. You're not just going to go home to your family because it's another holiday. And they did, and it got much worse. So,
but was there a moment when you felt it's over? We lost?
I held out hope.
Okay, well, let's move forward. So you stayed. You're wiser. I don't know if you were bitter or optimistic after that experience, but what were you thinking then in terms of applying your skills and knowledge experience after the Maidan? How did you end up in the activities that you're about to describe to us?
Well, like I said, it was that moment in the end of November 2013 that I just decided to do that. And actually, I adopted the pseudonym Mikhailo, from named after the church and the archangel, just because it was better to not be David Plaster on Maidan, because, well, Who would I be if I was just an American running around on Maidan living there, right? I would be Russian propaganda, potentially, right?
Yeah. But St. Michael's gold-domed monastery, that was also a makeshift hospital, was it not?
Yes. I took some of my money, my savings, and bought medical supplies and just kind of quietly gave them to people that I felt that was going to need them, and to try to restock that in advance. Medical, it's not just trauma supplies, in this situation. It's cold and flu medicine. It's hot tea. It's a McDonald's breakfast for the guys managing the block posts and a pack of cigarettes. That's sometimes the best medicine.
Well, when I met you a few years ago, I had the impression that you, as a young man here, you were still looking for your way, for your path. You were still searching for niches and where to express yourself best. And you seem to have come a long way in those last 3 years or so. Tell us how it started. What were your first aims to work in the medical rehabilitation, psycho-medical rehabilitation spheres? Or you're also at the moment teaching English and running various other NGOs. How did you start? What was your roadmap, if there was one?
Well, the war kicked off. I mean, I went down immediately after Maidan to Crimea. And 2 days before the referendum, I was let through the block post with packages of supposed American cigarettes and whiskey. Simply, if you take American packets of cigarettes and put Ukrainian Marlboro Reds in there, it looks a lot like American cigarettes. And was able to bribe my way across the border, because Ukraine and Crimea, it was just black-suited people managing the gates. So they let me through, just act like a confused foreigner that didn't understand the language. And what I saw was disturbing. I saw a lot of it wasn't democracy. There were buses of people with Russian plates being sentenced, as best I could tell, being given passports to go vote the next day, or 2 days to vote for as you could see on the billboards, either two maps of Crimea, one with a Russian flag or one with concertina wire and Nazi flags. So when you cut off communications and radio and TV and telling people that Kyiv is communist and Kyiv has fallen to the fascists, I mean, yeah. It's a logical choice that they're going to pick Russia, right? So it was brainwashing at its finest. Then I went back, and then the war kicked off in the next month in Slovyansk, and I offered support and medical aid in my knowledge and expertise training tactical combat casualty care in the U.S. Army and to the Ukrainians.
And what were your first impressions? Were the Ukrainians prepared for a conflict, or was the army in a very bad way? I'm not talking simply about weapons and morale, but dealing with casualties.
Okay, well, morale was high, of course. Right off Maidan, people were very patriotic. And there was lots and lots of support, sometimes too much support. Some commanders would kind of tongue-in-cheek say that they had too much. They didn't have enough of this, but they had more than enough food or something. They didn't have enough. And then some places had no food. It was just very disorganized. But the heart, and I've said this in previous interviews, the heart of the Ukrainian warfighter was very strong. And I still believe it's today. Equipment wasn't there. The training was... It was like us before we went into Iraq and before we went into Afghanistan. Our training in medicine was non-existent as well. It was just a medical pouch that had one bint in it. That was ours. And the training was to, you know, apply pressure and elevate. But oftentimes the soldier would put a pack of cigarettes there, and that was his first aid pouch. Very similar to Ukraine. So I saw a lot of the ways we roadmapped in America, and I basically copy-pasted it and said, if we have a NATO standard, and if you really want to be a NATO standard military, then take the NATO standard for medicine, copy it, paste it into Ukrainian, and work. And the allies would support you.
Were you on your own out there, or did you have others that were professionals in that sphere that could form a team with you?
There were people that were kind of around in different places, different organizations that did a lot at the beginning. I saw a lot of old standards being taught that people didn't know was not the current standard. They just found maybe on the internet or maybe diaspora sent that had some military affiliation, sent some old training manuals from the army. So that kind of helped them start. Again, I was not really wanting to get 100% involved in this because of the potential of what it could risk for the Ukrainian sovereignty if I was discovered. The propaganda would be, oh, there's an American
instigator
or something. Yeah, and I was just there as a peaceful agent trying to train and advise.
Okay, so let's, because time is short. Let's jump ahead. So your activities in that sphere now, what are you doing?
Well, to sum it up, I could say spent more than 15 months on the front lines training and assisting in medicine. Trained more than to this date, more than 7,000 Ukrainian service members have been trained by me and several times throughout the years, other trainers who have assisted me in that, to NATO standards of TT3. Currently, I consult the National Guard in helping to standardize military medicine, along with a couple of other groups, to consult and to standardize military training. There's a lot of people that do it really great with implementing at the schoolhouse level, and I work more on the implementation at the unit level. And been doing that quite aggressively for the last year.
When you say I've been doing that, you've created your NGO, an NGO to do that?
More of as an individual consulting, so official work, officially paying taxes in Ukraine, doing that just to not just do something and then it quickly being forgot about, trying to make lasting progress. The idea is that Ukrainians training themselves in Ukrainian in a NATO standard of medicine, tactical combat casualty care, or TC3. It's been very awakening for me to see the stops. I mean, we're on our fifth year of war and we don't have a standard when literally it was delivered in Ukrainian and said, do this and you will help save a large amount of lives. And even last year in Avdiivka in February, I had saw a dead soldier that died of venous bleeds, meaning he died of non-threatening. If somebody just would have put a pressure dressing, not even a tourniquet, the soldier would be alive today. It's my belief, simply because of lack of training.
But are we in a better position in terms of the Ukrainian armed forces, better trained, better prepared?
Yes, I would say so. I'd say the National Guard is much more ahead of the Ukrainian general army. They're smaller, but at the same time, they're better trained, especially the special operations soldiers that I work more with.
And David, you've got this fraternity, is it a drinking fraternity? Brothers, not in arms, but in linking raised glasses or something. Can you tell us about that, very briefly?
It's not alcohol propaganda, I can assure you. It actually stems from a very large international fraternity of brothers and sisters in arms. It's called Drinking Brothers. It's an American creation of some of my good friends from the U.S. Army. So if you're listening, American Drinking Brothers, this is for you. And thanks for the inspiration. I was contacted by some of them. They said, David, you live in Ukraine for so many years. They have a war going on. Maybe you should make a chapter of Drinking Brothers in Ukraine.
What does it amount to?
Basically, we have a motto. You don't have to drink alcohol. But if you do drink, don't drink alone. So we actually have little decals we pass out to service members. When we do a lot of training, we give them in, and we connect them to our online support. In about 4 months, we've amassed about 1,700 veterans and volunteers online in a closed group where they can share their joking and communicate.
So it's a sophisticated support system.
Oh, Facebook is a great tool for that, for communicating and connecting us.
It's where do you meet in Kyiv?
We meet at Pizzeria Veterano.
What's that?
Veterano Pizza. It's a veteran-owned pizzeria restaurant started by veterans, for veterans in the veteran community and also the non-veteran community, just to get a positive message out about veterans after war. The goal is, like, we do military training, NATO standard military medicine, right? That's one aspect. That's the war part, right? And I hope that tomorrow the war ends. But when guys come home, the war doesn't always end. So we basically create a network in the major cities across the country, and we reach out. So we have a social web of catching people. So when they come home, we can connect them. We can connect with people who we served with. And maybe your neighbor across the street or across town served in another division, another brigade at another time, maybe even Afghanistan here. And we have that common thing that we understand each other because we served. Maybe at different countries, maybe at different times, but we understand each other better than our own family can understand each other.
So to paraphrase that, it's soldiers in each other's arms.
Yes.
Let's now go to more broadly to your other activities. On your business card, I see there's an organization, an NGO that you're the president of. It's called Anomaly. Hmm. It deals with things ranging from education to orphans to ecology. Tell us a little bit more about what this involves and what was the thinking behind it.
The name or the...
Both.
Okay. Well, the name actually just comes from... I like to play on words. I love...
Puns.
Puns, yes. The word anomaly...
We have a lot of puns and pani in Ukraine, too.
Yes, and... I shouldn't say that word, but maybe panos also. But yeah. Anyway, anomaly. Well, in Ukrainian, in Russian, it's very similar, anomalia. So it's non-standard thinking. It's non-orthodox ways of approaching things.
Non-conventional.
Non-conventional.
Thinking outside the box.
Non-conventional social warfare, you could say.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's like the special forces of the United States Army say to liberate the oppressed. So maybe it's a way socially, social liberation from oppression. And the way I look at it is education is one of the greatest, most uplifting things that can really help people. So we've helped to date more than 20,000 plus students in English who maybe had some base of English, maybe had nothing from the Soviet Union or studied German in the Soviet Union, who are veterans and civilians, study English for them for free.
That's amazing. So how do you get your funding? I mean, okay, free, but your savings must have run out a long time ago.
No, I invest my pension, basically. I live basically on a Ukrainian standard salary myself, and then I basically take the pension from the military, and I give that to the cause. So I'm self-funded. Somebody bought me a cup of coffee. So just to declare everything this year, somebody bought me a cup of coffee. So on my next tax statement, you will see a cup of coffee declared from Aroma Kava that I did not buy myself. And I don't want to be honest here. I don't want it to look like there's some bribes or
Yeah. But surely you must have tapped into some grants or even got some government money to finance some of your projects.
I haven't needed it. The cost of one student for an entire year for three semesters, it's like 1.5 levels by the European Common Framework. The cost of one student to learn is $5. Mm-hmm. So
people listening out there, particularly in the diaspora, could really help here.
For the price of your Starbucks cup of coffee, depending on what you like, you could potentially fund one or two veterans or single mothers in Ukraine to study English for an entire year for the price of one Starbucks coffee.
Amazing. Okay, so Anomalia. This is now existed how long?
I'd say we're on our third year. Mm-hmm. But the idea, officially licensed it. But
is this a one-person operation, or do you have supporters? Do you have staff? Do you have colleagues?
I have a team of very loyal, very, very hardworking volunteers. Volunteers from all over the world. So some from the Ukrainian diaspora, some who have Ukrainian roots, and just a lot of Ukrainians that just really want to make their country a better place. Maidan was just the start of the revolution. Maidan was a wake-up for many people, but it's not the end of the revolution when it ended. No, not at all. When Yanukovych fled to Russia, that was not the end of the revolution. That was only the beginning.
Okay, you've partly answered my next question. So where are we at? We've made progress, obviously. Some would say the glass is half empty. Some would say that the glass is half full. How do you assess the situation in brief as a philanthropist, a person sort of looking from the ground upwards?
Well, there's a common phrase in Ukrainian, and then I'll say it and translate. Все буде добре, or everything will be good. But oftentimes you can look at somebody when they say it and you see in their eyes this other thought, Leonis Nayakakuli, but I don't know how and I don't know when. So we believe that when we all work together for a common goal, for really to make things better, put your money where your mouth is, put your time, put your resources, whatever you have towards that goal, only when you work together for that result, then it can only be better. And every one of our projects I've made, I specifically designed that a Ukrainian on an average Ukrainian salary can afford to fund a small project, and we can help them to do that. And that's the real anomaly, because anybody can come in here with money and do something, but not many people can really do something that is reachable for the Ukrainian people. And if you look more at my business card, you have a bunch of hands there. Those hands are the people in Maidan who really wanted a better future. A lot of old pensioners who never really thought they would see a better future for Ukraine, but they wanted it for their family. They wanted it so their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren, would really grow up in a place that they could be proud of. And really, and then only then, все буде добре. Але ми не чекаємо добре. We don't wait for good.
Right. So I get the impression that you're still full of zeal, idealism, and that has tempered the realism and whatever disappointments that, and there must have been many, that you've encountered.
Yes, I've been disappointed. But honestly, if I listen to critics, I listen to people say, you're not Ukrainian. Maybe you had some relatives that you're Ukrainian, but you don't understand. It's the same people that told me that when I predicted the revolution and the war. And I don't need them. I can do it by myself. I'm going to do this. My team, we're going to do this, whether people criticize us or not. And we've been doing this. So all I have to say.
So, David,
do you want to join us or not?
David Plaster, you seem to have found a place in your time. So Ukraine for you has become your mission field, as it were. Any final parting thoughts, which I always ask my guests to share? What would you like to say to our audience listening out there, based on your experience or projecting, looking forward?
Ukraine is a bright future, but only if people, anybody can say Slava Ukraini, anybody can say glory to Ukraine, but very few people are willing to do something that truly will bring glory to Ukraine. So that's a question I ask for your audience, many Ukrainian diaspora people. Stop and think to yourself, what are you doing to make your world a better place? What are you doing to make Ukraine a better place?
Thank you very much, David, on that philosophical and very inspiring, I would say, patriotic note. It's been a great pleasure to listen to you. Certainly, you've inspired me because we live in fairly cynical times when people are ready to dump on Ukraine and the world generally. And it's very heartening to meet an individual that has rolled up his sleeves and put his heart into practice and not simply carried his heart on his sleeve as an embroidered token. So thank you very much for coming to us.
Thank you for your time, sir.
And moving on to music. This week's song is called Rano, which means morning. It was recently premiered in Kyiv by the folk rock collective The Dukes, which is a play on the Ukrainian word spirit, duch. If you like their sound, you can hear more from their new album, which they've posted for free listening online. We'll post a link to it on our website. Enjoy.
Щоб воно лягло та й не встало,
And looking ahead, well, join us again next week when we'll bring you a topical, in-depth interview and some music. So tune in, and we would be happy to receive any feedback from you. Write to us at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. This is Bohdan Nahailo in Kyiv. Thanks so much for listening.